This is Amy Kitchener at the home of Susan Ahn on July 29th, 1993, for an interview with Susan Ahn Cuddy. Susan, when and where were you born?
I was born in Los Angeles in 1915.
And what is your full name in Korean?
Well, it would be Ahn Soo Sun. And I suppose spelled it would be S-O-O. S-A-N and A-H-N. And the reason the name got changed a little was when I went to kindergarten with the name Ahn Soo Sun, they changed it to Ahn Susan.
Really?
And that's, yeah.
What does it mean in Korean? Does it have a
meaning? Yes. The first character, Soo, is embroidered. And the second character, San, means mountain. And my father's pen name is Do San, which means lonely isle, Do being an isle, and the San meaning mountain. But it's, what would you call it, like a, like Mount Fuji, you know, where it sticks up in the island by itself in the big ocean. But he took that pen name because he, you know, I guess he felt like a lonely isle. But my name was supposed to be patterned after his.
So when you put it all together for your name?
It's Ahn Soo Sun.
And then the meaning is?
Embroidered mountain. Uh-huh. Ahn means peaceful, harmony. So it's a nice name.
Do you use that, do you use your Korean name still?
Oh, yes. Well, fortunately for me, for me, because I can carry the name of Ahn, which is more meaningful to the Koreans than my last name, which is Irish, the Korean custom is that you carry your maiden name. So it makes it very easy for me to be identified.
Yeah. And who were your parents, and where were they from?
My mother and father are from Paeyang in North Korea. In fact, they don't even call it Paeyang today, they call it Pyongyang. But they were born and raised there, and they came to United States in 1902. And my mother, the great warrior, decided that she was going to marry this man who had no future. And her father did say to her, you know, he's a very nice man, but he's never going to make any money. But she had her eyes on him, and so she decided to come to the United States with him. And she would have come without getting married. I mean, she would have just come with him. But the missionaries there, Dr. Underwood, said, you cannot go as a single woman. You have to get married. So they were married before they boarded the ship in 1902. And they came, and they came to San Francisco. And that's how they started their life here. And it's ironic. He came, she came to study. Because my father had felt that the Western democracy was the way that Korea should go. But when he got here to the United States, he found that in San Francisco, he found that there were a few Koreans there, merchants. There were the ginseng merchants. And they were still wearing their top hats and their little queues that they put on top of their head. You know, they hadn't cut their hair. They were not Americanized at all. And so when he saw this, he thought, you know, this is not the way, you know, that these people should be. So he went on a educational tour of the community and got them to cut their hair and look Americanized. And if there were any homes, you know, family homes, the story goes that he went into the homes themselves to help them to clean it up and put up clean curtains and to put flowers in the garden. But he felt that if we were going to live here for any length of time, that we should be as Americanized as possible and, you know, go along with American customs, you know. And so that's how he got sidetracked. Then, of course, 1905, the Japanese went into Russia, and there was a Japanese-Russian war in 1905. And, of course, that's when Japan took a protectorate over Korea, and Dad knew that, you know, we were in trouble. So in 1906, he went back to Korea and tried to teach them, you know, that they can't accept this kind of deal. And so he didn't come back. I mean, he stayed in Korea, Manchuria, and he didn't come back until 1911. And when he came back in 1911, he came through Vladivostok, Russia, all through Europe, and still preaching the story of how to save your country. Because in 1910, the Japanese had come over and taken over the country. And so Dad escaped. I mean, he couldn't stay there. So he came to the United States, and he taught people how to live a life of, well, let's say, sacrifice for the country. So he inspired the Koreans who had come here, because in 1903, I think there was a big labor wave that went to Hawaii to work in the sugar plantations, and so there were quite a few Koreans who had come in, and subsequently those Koreans came to United to the shores of United States, and a community developed. But wherever the Koreans had a community, Dad was there giving them the lesson of preserving and helping your country. Therefore, the early pioneer immigration group that came after 1903 is very important to the independence of Korea, because without them, there would have been no way that they could have helped themselves. These people who are pineapple pickers and in Hawaii, and rice field workers here in Los Angeles picking oranges. But if they earned a dollar, 50 cents of it went to the independence movement. And without that kind of funding, as meager as it may seem, but that was what kept the independence movement alive and going. And so the present-day Koreans have a great obligation to remember how they saved their country. Of course, my father was the great organizer. He organized the Korean National Association, which still has its building today on Jefferson, and which has been declared a historical landmark. And they have dedicated that area as the Tosan Anchang-ho Square. I think that's in remembrance of a dedicated hero who worked for the love of Korea. And in the meantime, my mother, who was always left alone with a bunch of children.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. You said he left in 1903 or 1904?
Well, he left in 1906. He came in 1902,
right,
and then left in 1906. Philip was born in 1905. Uh-huh. Then he didn't come back until 1911.
So your mother was in San Francisco?
Okay. My mother was, well, we're not really sure whether she, it was back and forth, San Francisco and Riverside. But there was a huge, not a huge, but a cluster of people living in Riverside, Koreans. They went there to pick oranges. And very interesting. They, let me see if, this is a picture of a Korean school in Riverside.
So the Koreans who came there, they organized in
Riverside.
and had different kinds of institutions like
schools and course independence movement meetings.
And then you had mentioned the KNA. What was the mission of the KNA?
Well, the mission of the KNA was to act as a source of aid to the Korean immigrants. We had no representation because we had no country. However, eventually this Korean National Association, which was developed when they acted as like mediators for labor disputes, and they acted as immigration consultants. They provided help to the Korean students who came, but it was one of these civic-minded organizations, and it was recognized by the federal government as a representation for the Korean people, since the Japanese were about to erase us off the earth.
Mm-hmm. You had mentioned that your father came as a student. Mm-hmm. Was your mother also studying?
Yes. Well, they both came to study.
Yes.
But it just didn't work out that way.
Did many Koreans, were they leaving Korea at that time and coming to study in the United
States? No, I think she and my father were about the first ones to leave. In fact, my mother may have been one of the first Korean students to come in. Subsequently, the Korean community was developed by picture brides and labor workers, etc. But the students that came in were not that many in numbers. There were quite a few, though, because I can recall meeting these students, because almost every student that came to the United States went through our home. And so they were dedicated. They were on my father's mission, you know, get an education, go back to Korea.
And but then their plans were halted.
Yeah, well, you couldn't go. I mean, the story stays the same with us. My father had said, for whatever you study something that Korea can use when she gets her freedom. My brother, Philson, who was quite artistic, wanted to take architect. And they said, no, you take chemistry, because then you can go to Korea and teach chemistry, and you can make bombs against the Japanese. So he altered his plans, which worked out all right. I mean, he wasn't so devastated personally, so, you know, it wasn't that bad. It was my sister and myself, we studied sociology, because, you know, we thought that Korea could use that type of education. And even my young brother, he's not young anymore, but at that time he took up education. You know. But each one was directed to do something with the future of Korea.
And all other brother?
Well, he was the actor.
Uh-huh.
He was set. You know, that's another interesting story on him. In the early days, when he was a minor, he was a very good friend of Anna Mae Wong. And he had taken Anna Mae Wong to her job at one of the studios. And it was she was working on Thief of Baghdad with Douglas Fairbanks Sr. And Douglas Fairbanks Sr. thought that Philip could have a part in that story. So he got a contract and he came home, because he was a minor. My mother had to sign it. When he brought the contract home, my mother said, over my dead body will you be an actor. You will disgrace your father. Because in Korea, in those days, it was not a recognized profession. It was, you know, not, it was not an education. It was not diplomatic. It was kind of low class. And so he failed to make his entry into that field at that time. In 1925, when my father came home, my brother discussed the future with him. And my father told him, yes, it's all right because it's an art. But he recognized that it was an art and not a low-class profession. And he said, but whatever you do, do your best. And so from then on, you know, he got the freedom to pursue his career.
And he really did.
And he really did. I mean, of the Koreans, well, past and present. In the past, in our days, it was, I mean, I don't know what, it was prejudice. I don't know about this racism, this word racism. But he did have some prejudices to work over. But, you know, in my mind, who doesn't? You know, somebody doesn't like you because you're a blonde. You know, it's the same difference. But it never stayed in his craw. I mean, he always worked it out. And he could cross any kind of a color line, and he was accepted everywhere. And I think that he could walk where no one was allowed. I mean, he was just that charismatic. And he did a lot for the community. He did a lot for the American community, and did a lot for the Korean community. And he did a whole lot for Korea itself, you know, because Korea was a forgotten nation, you know, and he, with his personality, you know, did a lot to keep Korea on the map, mm-hmm. I think.
Yes. Going back just a little bit, we were in Riverside. Then when did your family come to Los Angeles?
I'm not really sure. In establishing our residence, I don't know what happened between Riverside and, you know, where they went or how they went, but it looks like we established a home in 1914 on 1411 West 4th Street, is what it looks like to me. And then I was born there, and I was born in 1915. And then, since there are no records or letters or anything that I can tie it down to, we moved to 106 North Figueroa Street, and my sister was born there, and she was born in 1917, and so I think that's the way our residence went. The Korean communities were all outside of Los Angeles until about 1926. They were in Riverside, they were in Claremont, they were in Willows, they were up north, Sacramento, and then when they had crop failures, and I think it was 1926, all the families started to move into Los Angeles, and that's when Los Angeles became a Korean community.
I see, so there were very few families then at that time.
Yeah, well, when we were growing up, we were the only family, one family.
Really?
Yeah, one family. And it was.
What was that experience like?
I had a very pleasant childhood. I mean, and for one thing, we were. My mother was very open to the Americans. You know, there was no such thing as, you know, you can't play with them or, you know, you have to be careful of them or anything like that. They're welcome into the home, and Philip brought him home, and we brought all our friends home, you know, and it was fine. So it was, that was one burden that we didn't have to carry. And we didn't speak English until we went to kindergarten. We learned, you know, because no one spoke Korean. And even that was not very traumatic. I mean, we just sailed through.
And what was that area on Figueroa like? What do you remember about that?
Well, it was wonderful when we were growing up, you know, because the house was on a hill, and we had mud driveways, but that didn't matter. We used to slide down the banks, you know, but the area was, there were all kinds of little flats around the street, and there was a little store. It's ironically, USC has had a print in the Los Angeles Times not well, maybe 3-4 years ago of that corner where we used to live, so I cut it out. But it was very convenient. There was, well, in those days, there was no problem of prejudice of, you know, Orientals, etc. So it was kind of pleasant living there. Now it's what, the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion?
That's right where it was. So you were right on the edge of downtown, or really downtown.
Really? Well, it wasn't quite downtown. It was, since it's Figueroa, Hope, Flower, Hope. It didn't become downtown until about 6 blocks later.
So but did you do all your shopping downtown, or?
You mean, what kind of shopping?
Groceries or whatever you were going to buy. Did you have much occasion to go downtown?
Well, we didn't have much money, so we didn't go very far. We lived near Temple Street, which at that time was a Jewish community. And as I remember that street, it was like an old town. I mean, they'd have barrels of salted fish out in the front. But that was our help. I mean, we got along very well with the Jewish community. I mean, they were helpful to us. And I remember my father, when he was home, you know, we were very poor. And in the early days when we were not able to go out and work, it would be hard put to bring any food in. However, my father used to have these guests come in all the time, you know, for a consultation, etc. And he'd have them stay for dinner, my poor mother. So I remember running down to Temple Street to pick up a couple of salted herrings. And she would broil it, and she would always have rice, and then she'd have kimchi. And so that's what she had served his guests. But that was... eventually, though, we had a friend, let me see, I'm trying to figure out what year it was, but I had a, I didn't, it was a grocery store man who had a store at Flower and First, and his daughter came to the same school that I was in, and then I was appointed to tutor her, you know, and to show her around. And it was a Jewish family, but he owned the store at First and Flower. And if it wasn't for that man, we would have gone hungry sometimes. Because he would let us charge our food, and he even let Philip borrow carfare from him. And bless his heart, when we got money and we paid him for what we owed him, he would always give us cake or something of that sort. I mean, just a wonderful man. Now, with the daughter, I helped her, you know, get adjusted to the new school and everything. It was the fifth grade.
Where had they moved from?
Ohio. And we're friends to this day. She still calls me up. She's kind of nuts, but she still calls me up.
Oh, that's remarkable.
I have remarkable friends. And so she, you know, he helped us through our hard times. And then when we all got old enough to go out and work to make a regular, you know, meaningful living, I mean, it wasn't so bad. Mm-hmm. But
what was the school you were going to? What elementary school did you go to?
Fremont Avenue School. I guess it's been demolished now, but it was right down the hill from us. And we used to walk down there. Fremont Avenue. And then we went to Central Junior High School, that which is now, it used to be the LA High, and the Board of Education now houses some of its offices in it.
Is that on Temple?
Temple and what? I forgot. Something like High Street or something like that. I don't know. I've forgotten. But
What do you remember about going to school?
Well, I the one thing that stands out in my mind is that the first time I ever ran into pumpkin pie, I didn't like it. I love it today, but I didn't like it then because we had never had it. But it was on, I think, Thanksgiving or Halloween or one of those holidays, they served us pumpkin pie in the kindergarten. And but you know, when we were going to grammar school, grade school, the teachers were very good to us. I mean, there was no such thing as being prejudiced against, and there wasn't any problem with your classmates. I mean, so eventually, when I went to junior high school, all of us were kind of leaders. But I can speak for myself, as I was the president of the homeroom, and I was always on the baseball teams and things like that. So, and
so, was your father away
all this time? Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And was that very difficult for your family?
No, as my brother says in that article, he says he thought it was the way of life. You know,
the youngest brother.
Yeah. He accepted it as the way of life, and I think that's the way we also did. And since my mother was very strong, it really created no real hardship in growing up. And she never complained, you know. If I believe that if she suffered emotionally, then it would have been a hardship on us. But she herself was such a great patriot. I mean, she knew when she married my father what she was doing. I mean, she knew that this is a man of destination. And she did nothing but nurture him and help him and did nothing to stand in his way or to be a burden on him. And in some letters that he writes from prison, he didn't even have time to write to her, you know, because he was so busy. But when he got imprisoned, he was allowed to write one letter every 2 months. And he took that opportunity to write to my mother. And they are the saddest love letters you've ever read. You know, I will make up to you for all you've done for me. And when we get together and live as a family, we'll do this and that. And yeah, there was always a letter of hope and a letter of sorrow because he couldn't be a husband and a father. But there's one there that just makes you weep. I mean, you know. But since he was a writer, you know, he also wrote very well. You know, so he was, I don't know, unusual man. I mean, it just, the good Lord provided him to the country because they needed him so desperately. When I was in Korea in November last year, and they had a seminar called Fair Elections, and they were using the basis of his speech that he had made in 1898 for fair elections. So, but he's so, you know, every country needs a hero, and certainly he's the hero. And he has been recognized as a number one patriot. But he not only had to fight against the Japanese, you know, he was interested in educating the mass people. And he was a feminist, you know, because in the letters, I pointed out all the time, when he writes to my mother, he calls her by her first name and he signs his given name. You don't do that in Korea, you know.
What do they do?
Well, they don't identify you by name. They call you Yobo or, you know, something that's neutral.
What does that mean?
Yeah, but oh, I mean, just the hey. I think. I don't know. I mean, there's a better meaning than that. But he was. And then when we were in Korea sometime before that, Ralph and I were there together. I guess it was 1984. And they, in an interview, they said to us, can you give us any faults that your father had? And he said, because we have done research on him, we cannot find one fault. And he said, and they said, you know, it doesn't seem right to present a man that has no faults. So consequently, if you could name some, you know, give one pointer on the fault of his, then, you know, it would make the story better. And the reason they wanted to do this is they were going to present this man to the grade school people. You know, they didn't want to have this perfect image. But my brother and I looked at each other and said, well, only that he was a bad father was the only thing that we could. Yes. But we couldn't think of anything that would be demeaning or that he was not a gentle human being.
At the time, did you realize that, did you realize his importance?
Well, from the time that I can remember, it was always, you know, he's not your father, he's the country's father. And that was what we were raised with, you know.
And you could accept that?
Well, yeah, we all did. I mean, it's a strange phenomenon, you know. We all accepted that fact. And we all accepted this terrible thing they held over our head. You can't do this because you'll disgrace your father. You know, you can't do that because you disgrace your father, etc.
Do you think that was a motivating force? Because all of you are so successful in your lives, in your careers. Do you think that propelled you forward?
I don't really know how to describe that. And when I look at my family, I think that we're average people, you know, that have not made a huge success. I mean, Philip was the only one that made a startling success, as far as I'm concerned. My second brother, Philson, brilliant mind, was very successful at Hughes Aircraft, became a vice president in the days when it was not acceptable. But he... And, like, he was the president of the, what do they call that club? They have a club, the manager's club, you know. But he had some leadership. But, you know, I think that actually being the children of a great leader like my father, it suppresses you more than it enhances you, you know, because you always have that shadow of you can't do this because you'll disgrace your father, you can't do that. But since we all are the same blood, we have that same courage, you know, so when I...
For you personally, what were some instances of where you couldn't do something because of who your father was, of something you wanted to do but couldn't do?
For me personally?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there was anything personally. It was only Philip and Philson. Boys can and the girls didn't. We were brought up in a very traditional type home. The boys were the ones to be educated, and the girls, you know, forget you. However, being of the same metal, you know, we Sarah and I both went to college. I was one of the first women to leave the area to go away to college. And my poor mother, she really was great, though. I made my own plans. And I have another story to tell you about how I did this, but I made my own plans, and I went down and said that I was going to go to San Diego State. And she didn't object at all. You know, she never did anything to bar me or suppress me on that. She just didn't say anything so that, you know, she didn't have to say, well, I sent her, you know. But it just so happened that after I went to junior college, I had this very good friend that I had made, and she was going to San Diego State, and she said to me, she says, well, why don't you come down and we'll room together? So that was, and then she was the one that would assist me in funding, you know, so, because she had a sister who was a social worker, and I think the sister loaned us $50 a piece so that we could start our college career. And this was in 1933, so, no, 1935. And so then another girl was going down, the three of us would room together. And the next thing you know, Sylvia says to me, she says, well, I forgot the girl's name even, can't room with us because her mother objects to Orientals. So I said, well, that's okay. I said, I'll go down and see what I can do. So fortunately, the dormitory keepers were very wonderful people. I mean, they're like missionaries, you know, that kind of a mind. And so they look at this poor little Oriental girl, and so they helped me. They had a little side room off the pantry or something that could be a single. And so they gave me that. And so Sylvia and I went down. She stayed with the other group, you know, which were three or four in a room, I don't know. But that didn't bother me. I mean, because eventually what happened with all those kids that were in the area used to come to my room. You know, we used to just have fun down there. And but this lady that helped me go down there is my friend still today. We see each other once a week. And she did so much to balance my ethnicity, you know, because we were just talking about it the other day, and they didn't know what a Korean was. And they said, you know, oh, what are you? And we'd say, yes, and they'd say, Japanese, Chinese, Eskimo, Samoan, but they didn't know what a Korean was. And that's, but she always came to my aid, and she's been just a wonderful friend, and that makes it, 60 years, doesn't it? Yeah, but she's still, you know, she always says she's part Korean. But she was a big help because she balanced off my, if there were any racial problems, you know, I mean, having a white person around always help the cause, you know, so I really didn't have any thing. And then the good Lord was good to me because when I went down to apply for a job, the place that I got a job was speech professor's office, and he and I just became the most wonderful friends you could ever think of. I mean, we worked together, and we were just like peas in a pod. I mean, we kind of complimented each other.
This is when you got to San Diego?
When I got to San Diego. But the thing that it did for me was it, I was never very forward, you know, and I never was very, I didn't know how to speak very well. I didn't know how to present myself. But he taught speech and drama. And he made me come into some of his classes, like oral interpretation. And that, you know, helped me a whole lot. So by the time I joined the Navy, you know, when I got all this publicity, I was able to hold my own, although I was scared to death. You know, I mean, but it's still, since I had that little bit of backing, I was able to...
Okay, so then you were working there, and then you completed school at San Diego State?
Yes.
And what were you studying?
Sociology. Well, they call it social economics in those days, but I think it's sociology. So it was very. It was a very pleasant experience for me. I enjoyed it, and my mother was so proud of me. The whole community was so proud of me. They came down to
were
graduate.
Were you one of the very first? Korean-American women to go to college?
Yes. Look, there were a lot of women like who came from Hawaii who went to Michigan State, you know, and there were a lot of Korean women who came dedicated to go to college, but for us that were born in the United States, I think I was one of the first.
Mm-hmm. And what about Asian American? Other Asian Americans?
You know, I'm trying to think. In fact, there were no other Asians in my class. I mean, at San Diego State. I think I was the only one graduating. There were a couple of boys, but I think I was the only woman. So, and then when I got out, graduated, I stayed there to work as a counselor in the dormitory because, you know, there were no jobs. And then when I...
Was that because this is sort of the tail end of the Depression? Or?
Right, yeah. It was not because I was Asian or anything like that. It was just the way it was. And so I... Then when the Navy program opened up, I applied. And I didn't tell my family because I knew they would stop me. You know, my brother, big brother, and my mother.
Why?
Well, you know, no woman leaves home and goes and joins the Navy. I mean, you know, that just isn't part of their...
I mean, you had already picked up and gone to college. Now you're...
Now I'm doing something else, yes. But I swore in before I told them because I knew that they would stop me. And so...
So what year was this and what was the program?
1942. And what they did was they opened up a... they call it the WAVES program. It was a volunteer organization for the women, and it was part of the Navy, and it was the officers' group that first opened up. So I went down, and I applied for the officers' training, and do you know that they turned me down? And so I had a friend at USC who was in the dean of women's office, and she said, oh, she says, I'm going to find out for you, you know, what went on. Because the reason they turned me down was that I had not enough experience. And I had been working, and I had friends who were joining who had no work experience, just their degree. And so she said, there's something wrong. So she went down, and she found out that because I was, you know, Oriental, that they couldn't accept me. And in the Navy especially, you know, there were no Orientals accepted. No Orientals in practice at all, you know, in that...
What about in other arms, like the Army?
In the Army, yeah, uh-huh. We saw that World War II.
Yeah.
But in the Navy, you know, it was so elite, you know, so... But anyhow, so they turned me down, which was okay, you know. So a month later, the enlisted program opened up. And they wrote to me and said that I could enlist. One, you know, of course, there's a big difference between being a commissioned officer and enlisted personnel. I mean, like, you lose rank, you know. But anyway, I went down and I said to them, I said, you know, you turned me down for officers' training. You know, what would this mean if I enlist? And they said, oh, you could work yourself up to be a chief petty officer. I said, great. So I signed my papers. And they sent me to Cedar Falls, Iowa, and I also had a wonderful career. I mean, I had no, you know, I hear about stories of racism and prejudice and all this, and I don't understand it, you know, because I never experienced it. You know, I don't know. I mean, was well liked every place I went. I mean, it didn't matter the communities. The churches came to me and asked me if I would speak to them, you know. And I made press every place I went because I was Korean working against the Japanese, and my father was a patriot, you know. So, so with that kind of aura, I went to the Atlantic City. Was my yes, Atlantic City was my first real station where I had to went to Link Training School.
Let me back up for a second. What were sort of your ambitions or your interest or motivations to join the military?
Oh, just to fight the Japanese. That's all. Yeah, you know, but that's sort of in you, you know. Uh-huh. I mean, because of your father and your country, you know, you have no country. I mean, it's growing up without a country. I mean, you're a Korean, and you see all these people who have struggled to have your country back, and you're not getting it, you know. But that was my motivation, was to fight the Japanese.
Was your plan, the family's plan, to return to Korea when independence came? It was always sort of when independence came.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the things that my father really thought would happen, that we would get our independence and all our family would come to Korea and we would all live as a family unit. And but as time went on, you know, it just got too late, and then all of us got older. I mean, the plan just wouldn't work out. But the same thing happened to so many of the Koreans here. You know, they were waiting for an opportunity to go back, and that time never came. I mean, and I feel sorrier for the people who were born in Korea and wanted to go back than. And I don't feel sorry for ourselves at all, because I think that it's great that we're Americans. I mean, I think the good Lord really, really gave us a blessing. Never one moment did I ever wish that I was Korean in Korea. I mean, I pride myself in my heritage, and